Okay, my friends, we are going to try something new this evening. As you're probably accustomed to, whenever we study together, depending on what it is, if we're studying a primary text, we have a primary text in front of us. If we're doing a source sheet, it's a source sheet. So what we're going to be looking at this evening is the following document that I'm holding in my hands over here, which is my humble beginning to a Pesach Haggadah. It is nowhere near a critical mass that it's even worthy of a Hava, of possibly thinking of making it to a proper Haggadah, but who knows one day down the line. The real impetus behind this is that I wanted to give kind of a Seder buffet of different Pesach Haggadah insights. And what always happens to me is I get really flustered because, Haggadah, I have an idea for Kaddish. This one, I have an idea in Nirtzah. I don't remember which one at which point. And then I'm busy jumbling through all of the order of ideas in my stack of Svarim. So what I thought I would do was I thought I would actually take the time in order to put everything in a comprehensible order. And so what really just, came from that was that I found a template on Sepharia of a Hebrew English Haggadah. And what I did was I started basically doing three things. One is for English Haggadahs, I used a useful app called Google Lens that one of our congregants, Daniel Wallace, who works for Google, introduced me to, which one of the many functions it has is that you can take a picture of a page in a book and it's good at recognizing the text and you can basically select what you want, copy and paste it into a Word document. So there are direct excerpts from English Haggadahs. And then what I did was from the Hebrew Haggadahs, I took the time to adapt it into English for your reading pleasure. And then the third thing, which is the smallest part of the tripartite division, is that I put some of my own personal insights in there. And if you scroll, let me post just one more time for anyone coming in, because I don't think you can see the previous chat if you're joining now. So there you are. So for those just joining, the short thing that happened was is that I just started putting together a Haggadah. It's not ready, but I have ideas from English Haggadahs, adaptations I made from Hebrew Haggadahs, and then a little bit of my own personal insights sprinkled in. I endeavored to give proper attribution and to explicitly state what is an excerpt, meaning it's verbatim, and what is, what was adapted, which means, a little bit of my own bias went in there because it's not word for word. If you look at it, you'll see that there is, the bold in anything is generally from my own emphasis that I put in. So our goal this evening really is that I'm going to share a bunch of the ideas. This Haggadah is basically just ideas that I've come by in my journey, reading different Haggadahs and different works, and what really stood out to me and what piqued my interest. And my hope is it'll pique your interest as well. And so I'll share only some of the ideas. And then I encourage you, this is a living document. This isn't a statement about the Constitution or anything. This is actually a living document, and I hope to be adding more things. And of course, if you want, you can either look online at the link I gave you at the Google Doc, which is a live document. You'll see when there's new ideas that go on, or you can print it out and read at your own leisure. Okay? And with that, my friends, we begin. I'll make references inside the document by page number to those who are following along. And if you just want to listen, or you have a Maxwell Haggadah or whatever you want with you, I'll tell you what stage of the Seder we're up to. It shouldn't come as a surprise that a lot of the insights probably are around Maggid, but I try to make sure there are some insights on other parts of the Seder as well. And with that, actually, we go to page number two, because page number one is the title page. Page number two, if you take a look, immediately on Kaddish, I have something for you guys. Now, there is a story about the Chafetz Chaim. Happens to be I found it recorded in a Sefer on Zemiros by Rav Asher Weiss, but I've since found it in other places quoted as well. So it seems that it's a pretty accepted story that the Av Beis Din of Pressburg came to visit the Chafetz Chaim for Shabbos. And on Friday night, how does most Shabbos meals begin on Friday night? What do you begin with? Shalom aleichem, malachei Hashem. I won't sing the whole thing for you. Don't worry. When I grew up, we did each stanza three times, and I was like, no, we're only doing. When I got married, I'm like, we're only doing it one time. That was my big shift from the minhag hamishpacha, among other things. So the Chafetz Chaim actually went straight to Kiddush, wash made hamotzi. So then the Dayan of Pressburg asked the Chafetz Chaim, wait a minute, like I thought this was an Orthodox from observant household, even if it wasn't, everyone does Shalom Aleichem, right? I think. So what do you mean you're not starting the meal of Shalom Aleichem? What kind of rabbi are you? So he said, I looked around the table and I saw that there are many people who clearly looked like they were very hungry. So I figured people could get hungry. Angels don't get hungry. They don't have bodies. So let's serve the people some food first. And the angels could wait a moment until we sing Shalom Aleichem. So that's what he said. And so this is my personal recommendation when it comes to Seder. When you look at the beginning of Maseches Arvit, beginning of chapter, Perek Arvi Psachem, we're going to be talking about Psachem a lot. And if you're not familiar, that's the volume of the Talmud that talks about Pesach, Psachem. So there's already halachic restrictions on what and how much you can eat prior to the Pesach meal, what you're allowed to eat on Erev Pesach. Chances are, if you're like me or like many people, you're coming to the Seder and you're very hungry. And Karpas is just not going to do it. And it's not meant to do it either. It's just meant to whet your appetite. And then it's almost like a teaser, because then you get into Magid. And if any of you are blessed to have children or grandchildren at your table, these kids many times come home with a huge Encyclopedia Britannica of like everything that they want to share at the table. And then Magid begins to drag on forever. And by the time you get to Shulchan Aruch, you don't have an appetite. You just want to collapse out of exhaustion. So my recommendation, hopefully building on the precedent of the Chafetz Chaim, is that I always recommend, obviously it depends how many people are at the meal, what the circumstances are. It's always good to pick a few select ideas to supplement during Magid. And there's no halacha I'm aware of that says it's usur to learn Torah during the meal portion, during Shulchan Aruch. So why not just share the rest of the ideas while everyone is able to eat al hasova, and that way you're not holding other people back. So that's more of a practical recommendation, but I think it's very much based on Torah's sources. It's not just Moshe Kurtz being hungry. I think we have what to rely on over here. Okay, that was idea number one. Idea number two, if you turn to page number five. And now we are into Magid right at the beginning. And we say, and we start off with Halach ma'anya diachlu ava son of Ard Mitzrayim. This is the bread of affliction that our forefathers ate in the land of Egypt. Kol dichvin yeseh ve'yechol, kol ditzrich yeseh ve'yifsach. All who are hungry, come and eat. All who need to, come and what's yifsach? Partake in the carbon Pesach, and the Pesach offering is what it would seem to be saying. Now, here's the question that I'm sure it's occurred to many of you at some point. What's the big question? Isn't this the most disingenuous invitation I've ever heard of in my entire life? You already started the meal and now you're issuing an invitation, right? You don't need to be a big rabbinic scholar to ask this question. You just need to simply pay attention to the Haggadah. What kind of invitation is this in middle of the meal already? Once we've already begun the Suda, who's going to hear this? I always hear from people, they say, oh, there's a story and someone knocked on the door. I hear this all the time from different families where they say, oh, someone actually did show up around then. Different families have different variations of that happening to them. It's very amusing. But there are a few approaches that are given. One approach is given by Rev Eliezer Ashkenazi, which is, he says, you're misunderstanding what Kol Dichvin Yesev Yechol is. The reason you're so bothered by it is because you misunderstood what it's actually saying. It's actually not an invitation. It's what we call a kina, like kinos. We read on Tisha B'Av, it's a lamentation. What could we be lamenting on Pesach night? We're lamenting that, if we recall, I know a number of you have done Mishnayos Pesachim with us. If you recall, when you eat the carbon Pesach, There's supposed to be a chabura. There's supposed to be a preordained group of people who are gathering together to eat from that carbon Pesach. You can't just willy-nilly show up. It has to be pre-designated. Now, on the one hand, the fact that anyone can show up, anyone wants to come in and can now partake in our carbon Pesach or afikomen, which is in lieu of it. So on the one hand, it's nice because it affords us flexibility, but we know anything serious in life requires us to go through procedures and through red tape. You know, you think about it, if you want to travel out of country, you have to go get a passport. So you have to go to the passport office, you have to go through this, you have to go through that, sign that, get a photo and a mail to this, and it's a whole balagan. Anything that is worthwhile requires preparation. That's generally how it works. So the fact that it's much more flexible and much more casual detracts from the reverence and awe that we're supposed to have for the Karan Pesach. So he says it's a lamentation. My Rebbe, Rav Tendler Zatzal, he also sought to answer this question by also dismissing the commonly held interpretation of Halach Ma'anya. Again, it's not that it's an invitation, but also he doesn't suggest that it's a lamentation either. Rather, it is a halachic declaration that we are making. What's a halachic declaration? Well, there is not all of us have heard of it. There's a halacha that the Karban Pesach, the Pesach offering, needs to be eaten al hasova. What's al hasova? What it means is you shouldn't eat it ravenously. Rather, after being, 90% full for most of your meal, that's why we have the afikomen at the end, by the way, then one is supposed to eat from their Karban Pesach. That way you can savor the experience, right? And remember, the taste is supposed to remain in our mouth as well. One's supposed to savor the experience. Now, it used to be lamb back then. You know, that's why it's more matzah, woohoo. So it was a little bit of a different experience back in the days of yore. So now how do we read the line? Kol dichven yesev yechal, all who are hungry, let them come and eat. Fill yourself up 90%. And now once you have eaten, you've consumed enough food that you are sated, now all who are in need of what? I already ate. What else do I need? All who need to fulfill the mitzvah of the Karban Pesach, come and partake in the Karban Pesach. So it's not a invitation like is widely assumed, but it's a halachic declaration. And so just to be aware, I'm sure there's others that I haven't seen. There's many answers that are given. There's a mini encyclopedia. You may have seen when we learned Gemara together, I'll refer sometimes into Masifta Gemara. It's kind of like a modern mini encyclopedia. So there's a Masifta Haggadah, which almost any question you can anticipate, it gives you 10 answers from across the gamut of Haggadahs that you could possibly look at. So if you go there, I'm sure you'll find more answers. Okay, that is idea number two that I'm leaving you with. Alex, I see a hand that is arisen.
So I am a little confused because that declaration is in the beginning of Seder, and Karban Pesach is supposed to be at the end, or at least not at that moment.
Right. So it's an excellent point. I shared this between Mincha Marv just now, because at shul. So Nat Sandberg ran after me as I was walking over to the classroom where I'm at right now to give the shiur. And he was asking me exactly that question, Alex. So, great minds think alike. It's a good question. What's it doing over there then? I don't have a good answer per se, but maybe I have an approach that might help us appreciate this. If you take a look on page number 10, so now we're looking at Avadim Hayinu Lefaro B'Mitzrayim. So now this piece is actually excerpted. I marked it as such. This is a excerpted from the Rosh Salvechik, an exalted evening Haggadah. Now the thing is, it says I'm excerpting it from that Haggadah. It's not, this Haggadah wasn't written directly by Rav Soloveitchik. Rabbi Ginnack, who is a huge Shama Chacham, one of the heads of Kashrus, or maybe the head of Kashrus at the OU, he spent time collecting, culling ideas from Rav Soloveitchik from various different svarms. So I'm not sure if it's like a cliche or cliche, this by how many times removed, but it's a verbatim quotation, at least from the Exalted Evening Haggadah. So in there, Rav Soloveitchik makes a really important point. He says that it's true. He does discuss also the imperative of telling over the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim, of Laharos Esatzmo, feeling the experience. He talks about how it's supposed to lead us to praising God, all wonderful things. But one thing that tends not to get emphasized so much many times is that he says on page 10, the night of Passover is first and foremost a night of Torah study. What does that mean? First and foremost, a night of Torah study. The citations in the Haggadah from the Tosefta and the Mechilta, the oral law, concentrate on the major laws of the Exodus of Egypt so that we'll be able to fulfill the commandment of discussing the laws of Pesach. Without discussing the laws, the Haggadah cannot begin. So to your point, Alex, I think it's still a little bit of a question why this halacha in particular, but it would seem that the Baal Haggadah wanted to emphasize that Torah study and study of both halacha in addition to the Haggadah is of utmost importance and is a core component of the Seder night. Why that halacha in particular? Good question, but there we have it. Okay.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Rabbi, the people that asked why is it there where it is, where would they have it? Where would they see that it would fit better than where it is?
Well, maybe
I can't see it.
Maybe for Shabbat Art, before the meal, one can say, right?
Well, it is, isn't it?
Well, it's only at the beginning of Magid. It should be all the way at the end of Magid, but once we start eating things, actually. Or not just the carpus, but we really start eating.
But it's still at the beginning, and maybe when it was written, the Haggadah, when it was put together, that it had to go someplace. It couldn't go at the end because you're talking about eating and you've already finished eating. So that would be only talking about the Korban Pesach at the end. But then what happens to Kol Dechvin Yetev Yechol? So it's like, you know, beginning and end, and you have to have a place to put it.
Right.
So where else would you put it?
I hear that.
My favorite part about sandwich with a Pesach.
Yes, the sandwich, the best part. All right, Rabosai. We still got a number of ideas to cover. I'm going to set myself a limit. I should probably finish. We start with 7:35. Okay. I should probably not take more than 45 minutes to get this stir. All right, good ideas. Let's go. We're only on page 10. we're not going through everything. Don't worry. Don't get scared, guys. I don't want to hold you captive. Okay. Now, on the same page, there is another idea from Rav Soloveitchik that I found compelling, in which Rav Soloveitchik notes that we say, if we look up in the Hebrew or in the English, it says, Avadim hayinu, hayinu, lefaro b'mitzrayim, b'mit, right? What's that saying? We were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt. Now, Rav Soloveitchik didn't live into the 21st century when this became a little bit more of a catchphrase. But what he's going to be referring to is what we now call person-first language. So, for instance, you don't say nowadays a special needs kid. You say a kid with special needs because that doesn't define who they are. They are, you know, people are humans and humans have, you know, certain challenges, right? So That's in the clinical world, that's the norm. So Rav Soloveitchik actually made that observation as well in the Haggadah. You see, we are called Avdei Hashem. We are called servants of God. That defines what our essence is. However, it doesn't say that we're Avdei Paro. It doesn't say that we're the slaves of Paro, but rather it says Avadim Hayinu Paro. We are people who happened to be serving Paro in Egypt, but it didn't define our very essence. And let me read the actual line in the bold. Had they been slaves existentially, had they lost their love of freedom and their spiritual heritage, had they been Pharaoh's slaves, and not just slaves to Pharaoh, they never would have been liberated. Right? We were on the, as the Kabbalah tells us, we're on the 49th level of Tumah, of impurity, but there was something that was keeping us afloat, and it was the fact that we were still intrinsically servants of God, and we were just being removed from our primary function, our primary essence at the moment. So that was an observation that Rasal of Egypt made that also I found quite compelling. And now we are going to actually skip footnote 6 and footnote number 7. But again, I just want to remind you that you have the opportunity to, I gave you the link. And if you don't have the link, if you lose it, you can email me. You can print this out and you could read it when Dominic goes super long on Pesach and need something to read. I humbly submit this before you. If my sermon is very boring, maybe you'll want to read my paper instead. I don't know. Okay, let's go forward. Let's see. Okay, if you glance at page number 14, how many of you, again, it's not a good way to get a raise of hands for this one. I'll say this one really quickly because this was my sermon this past Shabbos. But I understand that I was only at the 7 and 8 o'clock minyan, and many of you attend the 9 o'clock, so you didn't hear it. But for some of you who were at the 7 or 8, I don't want you to have to hear it with all the details again. So very quickly, on page number 8, there's another excerpt from the Rabbi Norman Lamb Haggadah, which I actually have right here with me. I was fortunate to be in a... I still am, thank God, in a WhatsApp group of rabbis across America, basically all YU rabbis. And someone just one day posted that Amazon was selling this for under $5. Meanwhile, the list price is over $20. And so we all converged on it and started buying it. 3 minutes later, so someone posted in a WhatsApp group, where's the sale? I don't see it. Turned out, the algorithm saw that everyone was buying it, so it shot the price back up once it saw it was popular. Thank God I was one of the first people who jumped in there, and I got it for under $5. But certainly, as I share on Shabbos, the ideas in there are certainly worth a lot more than $5. And here's one of them. When we talk about the Arba Banim, we talk about the four sons. Well, we give a lot of airtime to the Russia, the wicked son. Maybe we talk about the Chacham somewhat, the Shino De'elishal. Everyone likes to talk about, maybe it's from Lubavitcher Rebbe, I forget who says, what about the fifth son, the one who's not even at the table? But no one really talks about the Tam. Who's the Tam? The Tam is the, we generally translate, most people translate as the simple son. Now, simple sounds like a pejorative. It sounds like you're calling him a simpleton. Like, he doesn't know any better. But actually, Rabbi Norman Lamb says, he quotes the Akedas Yitzchak, who says, that Tam is from the Lashon of Tamimus, of wholesomeness. It's not the simple son, it's the wholesome son. He says that for a while, the Jerusalem Talmud clearly declares the Tam to be one who is bolted intellectually, calling him a tipesh or fool. Akedas Yitzchak maintains that he's not typed intellectually, but religiously and ethically. The Tam is not the opposite of the Chacham, but he's the opposite of the Russia, of the wicked son. Now, unlike the Chacham, who might like to show off how much he knows and all of his doctoral degrees and accomplishments, the Tam is a person without pretenses, who does not wear his lumdus or scholarship on his sleeve. And he quotes what is a classic Or HaChaim, Or HaChaim reflected, that back in the days of the persecutions and inquisitions, it was those who consider themselves most philosophically sophisticated who were able to rationalize all these different kinds of heterim within Judaism, that eventually they applied the same tools, the same frame of analysis, and they rationalized leaving Judaism when it suited them. But in the end, it was the masses, the women, the children, the men who maybe didn't have the college degrees, you know, those who didn't go through all the liberal arts education, they were the people who were more wholesome. And they were ultimately the people who put their foot down and were willing to sacrifice themselves and martyr themselves for God. And it's because of those people who we would call the Tam. It's because of the Tam that Judaism was preserved and lives on today. It was about, I'll just share something. I guess I'm giving the whole sermon after all. I couldn't resist. Marissa and I were having a conversation a few days ago about whether to cover our countertops. So I said, Marissa and I, we have a small counter space. So we use the same counter for meat and dairy during the year. And we know that since hot dairy may have fallen on a counter, I know if a hot piece of meat falls on the counter, we don't eat it because maybe then it absorbs some of the dairy taste that previously fell on the counter. So we shouldn't, all we need to do for our counters really is wipe them down for Pesach, but there's no reason to kosher cover it. But Marissa said to me, she said, wait, but when you walk into a Jewish home, isn't there the red tape? Isn't there the yellow tape? Isn't there, you know, isn't it supposed to look like it's like, you know, people should be in hazmat suits, right? How do you think our bubbies and Zadies in Europe used to do it? You know, like, bubby and Zadie don't live in Europe. They're in the five towns, right? I see the rest. Our bubbies and Zadies back in the five towns. How did they, maybe you're just going back to Russia and then Europe and wherever we're from, right? So, you know, did they not? They, of course, they covered their counters with aluminum foil or whatever they were using back, right? It's the only anachronisms. So I was like in principle holding a line. I'm like, no, we're not covering our counters. Then I read this piece from Rabbi Norman Lamb, and I said, you know what? Maybe there's a lubdisha way I can explain why we don't need to do this. But you know what? Minhag Yisrael Torahi, the most wholesome people we know, this is what they did. And this is what's preserved our Masorah. I said, Marissa, if you really want to cover the countertops, I permit. Okay, I said I'll help you. I'll help her out as well. So, right. Someone came over to Marissa after she said, and she said to her after the sermon shout, she said, you know, I hope Moshe helps you cover the countertop. He doesn't just let you do it. I hope he helps you cover it. Maybe it was one of you who said that. Anyway. Okay, moving forward, my friends, moving forward to page 17. The word b'mesemaot. So it says b'mesemaot that we were a small in number. What's it mean we're a small in number? So I actually, we don't need to go deep into this, but do you see where this excerpt is from? I excerpted from our book that we're using on Thursday mornings. From Ani Mamin by Dr. Joshua Berman. Actually, I put a rabbi, Dr. Joshua Berman. I think he has smicha also. So Professor Berman has a very nice piece that we did in our Thursday morning book club class, but I excerpted it here if you want to see it, where he notes that it would seem that the Jewish people were never a huge people, and even some of the words in the Torah, like b'mesei ma'at, seems to indicate that. So if so, how do we say that? 600,000 men of fighting age left Egypt. There's all these inflated numbers, these rounded off numbers. And basically, in his masterful work, he says, ultimately, that the sums indicated for each tribe are not a reflection of the actual numerics, not an actual statistic, but rather it's a reflection of their status. So the fact that, you know, Shimon was lower down, because Shimon, of course, after the whole episode of killing out the city of Shechem, he lost his proper status. And if you look at Reuven's number is twice the amount of Shimon because he got a demoted firstborn double right, that he was only got double the amount of the lowest son. So he goes through all of that. It's really wonderful. And again, it's there to read at your own leisure. And I know a number of us already studied together on Thursday morning, so we're not going to spend a lot of time on that. Going forward, you will see on page 11, I actually, from my, some of you I know, it's our Monday night class that I write up also, our halachic adventures through the Parsha. So I included two mini essays in here, one on the frogs and one on, what else? Oh yeah, one about Moshe Rabbeinu killing the Egyptian. So these are mini essays. They're there for you to read at your own leisure. They're actually like entire shiur that we did together, summarized and distilled. So we've actually studied together during this Monday night slot. So I need not spend time on that right now. If you take a look at footnote number 12 on the bottom of page 23, it goes on to page 24. When it says, the es amaleinu elu habanim, and our toil, this refers to the sons that were killed, thrown into the river. But Rav Zilberstein homiletically interprets. Now, here's the thing. Many times you'll see when a rabbi gets up to give a sermon or is writing a commentary in the Torah, there's two ways to approach Al HaTorah literature. There's some people, many of the Rishonim, who are actually trying to explain what the Torah is saying. They might have different approaches to how much they feel beholden to what the sages in the Talmud and Medrash had to say. But basically, when you open up a Mikros Gedolos, for the most part, the Rishonim are trying to explain what's going on actually in the Torah. That's their goal. Now, sometimes their explanations might yield an inspirational and uplifting idea, but that's just by happenstance. However, the modern day literature, a lot of it is more homiletics, less literal, less actual interpretation, in which we kind of just find a few words that we like, and then we springboard and talk about what we wanted to talk about anyway. So this is one example of many. Rav Zilberstein's Haggadah, he talks about children, and we actually covered this when we talked about children in shul on Purim. He quotes the Gemara in Chagiga talking about Hakel, who says that children are supposed to come to Hakel. And the classic question is, what do you mean? Why bring children to Hakel? Why bring children into shul? Are they going to create a disruption? So he quotes the Sfas Emes. The Sfas Emes, I put the full quote here. It's translated from his Hebrew summary. That, again, the word Shlemus comes in. He says that even though children might create a little bit of a distraction from our own religious endeavors, it's the job of a parent to be willing to give up a little bit of their own religious self-reflection and self-improvement and sacrifice a little of that for the sake of their children. Maybe I wouldn't be able to learn all the same hours of Torah each day, but that's our job, is to give away a little bit of ourselves in order to ensure that the next generation is able to thrive. And he quotes the Gemara in Shabbos, which says that Yerushalayim was destroyed because the Tinoko Shel Beis Rabban, the children were interrupted from studying their Torah. And the way we rectify it, the Gemara tells us, it would seem, the way we rectify it is that even when the Beis HaMikdash is being rebuilt, we're not supposed to distract our children from studying Torah. So it was interesting. I actually saw someone post on Twitter today that because of all the politics in Israel, they canceled first period in school at a day school in New Jersey, and they decided to give them an overview of what's going on in Israel right now. I assume first period was not, you know, Gemara or Chumash or something, but it's not a small thing to consider when you know. I'm giving myself mussar. You know, when I have to be careful before canceling a class. I have to think to myself, wait a minute. You know, I have like 16 wonderful people who want to log on and learn Torah. You know, if I cancel a class, that means I'm depriving them of an opportunity to study. Now, I'm sure you're all, whenever I cancel and move that, you take out a safer and you're learning something else on your own anyway. But, you know, it's a calculation that I have to make. So that's... I put the hyperlink to the article from the class. We did a whole class on this, so there's a write-up of that. Okay, going forward, Rosa. Any questions? Just anyone have any questions? All right. The next idea I wanted to share with you comes up when we're talking about the 10 plagues on page 31, the 10 plagues. So the plague of Barad, it says... let me see if you don't mind. There's a chumash right here. I just want to grab the chumash so I can quote it from inside.
The moment. I think we have a chumash here. Here we are.
And if you have a chumash, you're welcome to take a look yourself. Okay. So if you want to take a look at Exodus chapter 9, verse 20. Exodus chapter 9, verse 20. So it says in describing the plague of hail, Hayarei es devar Adonai me'avdei paro, heinis es avadav es mikneu el habatim. So all those who feared the word of God, those from the servants of paro, they brought all their possessions inside their homes to protect them from the hail. Now, how does it describe those who did not bring in their possessions to protect them from the hail? You would think it would say, and those who did not fear God didn't bring in their possessions to save it from the hail. But that's not what it says. It says, Rabbi Lamb points out, Basher lo sum libo el devar Adonai, those who did not place their heart, did not pay attention, who did not care to pay attention to the word of God, by they left their possessions in the field. Rabbi Norman Lamb points out that that is what he calls it the, oh, did I not underline it over here? 1 second. Oh, I opened up the wrong, I have a few copies of Haggadahs, just in case there are people who showed up. I had some hard copies. I grabbed the wrong one. I have my annotated on top of annotated one over here. So Rabbi Lamb says, oh, the pages are also changed also in here. Ah, here it is. He says, ours is a greater, subtler, and deeper sin. He's referring to what's our sin nowadays. We do not absent ourselves from the synagogue because we are actively atheistic. It is just apathy. We do not desecrate the Sabbath because we dislike it. We are just religiously, someone get a dictionary, religiously phlegmatic. I don't know what phlegmatic means. Sounds like, it almost looks like the word phlegm. But it sounds, basically what he's saying is that the opposite of fear of God is not fearing God, but it's apathy. It's that I know what the right thing is. You know I should be eating from a dairy restaurant with a proper hashgacha on it. But you know what? It's not worth the trouble. And that's generally the Yetzirah that most people have. Most people in principle are not opposed to things like Hashrus and Shabbos and other areas of Torah, right? We love learning Torah. But sometimes it's more apathy. It's that we're not, again, in the Lashon of the Pasuk, Rabbi Norman Lamb says, Basher lo sum libo el dvar Adonai. They did not place their hearts. They did not pay attention. That's how you say, simale, pay attention. That's how you say it in modern Hebrew. They just didn't care to pay attention to the word of God. So that's what Rabbi Lamb points out on the Makkah of Barad. Skipping over Choshech, it's a nice story from Rabbi Bender that I included. Rabbi Bender, of course, was the Rosh HaYeshiva of Yeshiva Darchei Torah, where I went preschool through high school. So I thought it'd be very nice to get something from his Haggadah in there. He has a nice story in there from Rabbi Shlomo Freifeld, definitely worth reading. And then going to footnote number 16. Again, back to Rabbi Norman Lamb. I have to say, this was the best buy ever in terms of Haggadahs, even without the price. Rabbi Lamb just has it's a treasure trove of beautiful, you know, Divrei Torah and observations, sermons, ready, you know, just waiting to be given. So he notes that when we're talking about how many plagues there were, on the water, that they got struck with 50 plagues at a time. Rabbi Lamb says, you know, it's almost worth reading it. He says, all the other plagues merely repeated these lessons. Therefore, the Torah made no mention of them. For the great purpose of Torah and the messianic hope of Israel is not only iconoclasm, the defeat of godlessness, but education, the establishment of godliness. It's not just, you know, I'll add my own words, not just sur me ra, but ase tov. Evil is expunged by being exposed. Falsehood is undone by being unmasked. A living lie is best denied by being debunked. The aim, I have to do like this with the Rabbi Lamb oratory. I'm sorry if I'm not obviously on the same Adrega. The aim of Judaism in this is the struggle between good and evil. It's not so much to lay low the forces of evil as to lay them bare. Not so much to revile falsehood as to reveal it as decaying, as mean, and above all, as a failure. And then finally, at the end, Rabbi Lamb says, skipping a little forward, the punishments and plagues were not blind vengeance. They were meant to be a lesson and demonstration for all generations. And their ultimate purpose is the most noble and glorious known to mankind, that you may know that I am the Lord. So Rabbi Lamb, in classic fashion, I remember when I was in high school and I read Rabbi Lamb's Torah Umada, his magnum opus, making the argument for the synthesis of Torah and general world knowledge. So I met with him when I was, I believe, in 11th grade. I went to YU for the first time in my life. You know, the funny thing is, because I saw all these like movies about, you know, college campuses, and it's always like sprawling green hills. It's like all lush and everything. And so I was like, oh, I can't wait to go to YU. It's going to be such a nice college campus. And then as we're driving up, and I look out the window, and the guy says, oh, we're at YU. And I'm like, this is Harlem or something here. This is YU. What? So anyway, they clearly have not decided to relocate yet. I'm not going to weigh in on that part, or I just did actually. But my meeting with Rabbi Lamb, in there, I don't remember all the contents of the meeting. It's obviously been a while, but he made the point very strongly to me. He said, you know, never let anyone tell you what to believe. You should, you should make intellectual assessments to the best of your ability. He was very, very pro being able to not have people kind of prevent you from being analytical and from being independently thoughtful. Okay, moving forward, I think we'll have to wrap up very soon. So just a few more ideas. Those following were on page number 36. We're up to Dayenu. So if you look in Dayenu, it says, Ilu kiravnu lifnei Har Sinai, had God brought us before Har Sinai, God did not give us a Torah, Dayenu. And then it says, God gave us a Torah, but did not give us the land of Israel, also Dayenu. Now, you can usually figure out someone's hashkafa based on which line bothers them more. Are you more bothered by going to Har Sinai but never getting the Torah? Or are you more bothered by, we got the Torah, but we didn't get to go to Eretz Yisrael? So there's sometimes it's always funny to see which possibility bothers people more. You try that around the Seder table and see. The rabbi, coming back to our friend and teacher, the Chafetz Chaim says that the author of Dayenu, notice how he says, had God given us the Torah but not brought us to Israel, Dayenu, but it's inconceivable for the opposite to be true. It doesn't say, had God brought us to Israel but not given us the Torah, Dayenu. Now, you can just say, oh, well, it's chronological. Okay, that's probably pshat. But the Chafetz Chaim says, because even though the ideal state of Judaism is that, I think in Bnei Akiva they say this, Am Yisrael, Be'eretz Yisrael, Pi Torah Yisrael. Ideally, Judaism is supposed to be practiced, God's law should be practiced in God's land. But we've been through a long exile. I'm pretty sure all of us here are not living in the land of Israel right now. The Torah is able to sustain us no matter where we are. But to be in God's land and not keeping God's laws, are you talking? No, you can't say Dayenu or something like that. If we're going to be in God's land, it has to be according to God's laws. That's how it has to be. Mm-hmm. So that's why it says in there, Elu kiravnu lifnei Har Sinai, lo nasal nasat Torah Dayenu, but not the opposite. That's what the Chafetz Chaim suggests. Going forward, let's see. We're gonna get into the final stretch. All right. Well, we're done with Maggid insights. Okay. So I gotta let you guys eat. We gotta start eating now, right? I guess next time we use Seder insights, we should actually do it around the table with some food. We can have some fun with it, right? Okay. There's a nice story about Maror. Naturally, as you guessed, it's related to the Holocaust and from Rav Rimon's Haggadah. So you can take a look at that at your leisure. See, I'm giving you guys a lot of homework, right? Going forward, recovering a lot of ground over here. I also put in something to read at your own leisure. I think we've done a shiur on it possibly. Footnote number 20 on page 48 is about, do we celebrate the downfall of the wicked? A very classic topic because I guess just very briefly, but of course there's much more to it. The Beis Yosef quotes the Gemara that tells us that when the Egyptians began to be, when they were drowned, the angels began to sing. And God says, how can you, angels, how can you sing when Masiyadai Tova Bayam, when my creations are drowning in the sea? So the Beis Yosef basically cites precedent that the reason that we don't say a full Hallel the rest of Pesach is because there's something missing from our simcha when we know that it was to the detriment of other human beings, no matter how wicked they are. There's a whole discussion about if and when we celebrate the downfall of the wicked. It's a whole shiur. Maybe we'll do it sometime. And I wrote just a little bit of it in the Haggadah here. Okay, now we're up to Hallel. Oh, we're really covering ground over here. In a Hallel, something else that we don't need to go through in depth because we did it for those who are in the Thursday morning class. Now I'm quoting from Rav Amnon Bazak into this very day. Rav Amnon Bazak. So I was so happy when I found the tie-in for this. So you remember Rav Bazak, he's not the only one who mentions this, but we saw this together, so I put it in from his book. The Rav Bazak notes that in the commentary, the Torah commentary of Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid says that Hallel HaGadol, Psalm 136, was actually originally in the Torah, and then King David came along and spliced it out of the Torah and plagiarized it into Sefer Tehillim, which is an outrageous claim. Where did he come up with that? I mean, it's just like gratuitous. Like, why? So in here, I put an excerpt from the book where he talks about how Rav Moshe Feinstein and others were so enraged by this, they claimed the book had to be a forgery, or at least those sections of Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid were forged, and they forbade the printer from reprinting with those sections in there that they found problematic. There are other sections in the next Shuvah Moshe talks about where he takes a little bit more of an understanding stance on homosexuality. So that was something we did in a class already, so we're not going to elaborate here. But again, I put the full I put an excerpt in there for your reading leisure. Finally, we'll conclude with one last idea. And I realize it's Chataini Maskir Hayom. I skipped the brisker rub at the beginning of the Haggadah on reclining on a seva. We'll leave that for another time. But again, it's there for you because how can a Haggadah have a shame Haggadah, a true status of a Haggadah, if it doesn't have the brisker rub in there? It doesn't have the brisker Torah, either on a dalakosos or on reclining on a seva. The final idea I'll share with you again, going back to our good friend Rabbi Norman Lamb, and I believe this is the final idea that I included in the Haggadah. Yes, confirmed, the final idea, all the way in Nirtza, page 57, footnote number 22, the 22nd and final entry, at least, God willing, for the time being. He picks up on what says, Danta Melech Gerar, on the fourth line there, that God judged the king of Gerar, which was Avi Melech. It's a short one, so I'll read it out loud for you. And with this, we'll conclude. And we're almost at the hour mark. Avimelech says to Avraham, after God had appeared in a dream and reproached him for taking Sarah to his royal harem, what made you do this? To this, Avraham answered, because I said that there is no fear of God in this place. What is the meaning of this exchange between them? According to some of the commentaries, Avimelech said to Avraham, understand your ruse with regard to the Egyptians. They are dreadfully immoral people, and therefore you had to do what you did. However, we are a moral, good, and ethical people. Why did you feel it necessary to ensnare us with this ruse? Avraham then answers, it is true that you are a good and moral people. I admit it. However, if there is no piety, or piety, I always forget. If there is no Yiras Elohim, no fear of God, then I cannot trust that you will remain decent, for your ethics may well prove unreliable in the face of overwhelming passion and temptation. If there is no religion, if there is no true faith in a God above, what is to prevent you from making up your own laws and moral code as you go along simply to fit the situation? In such a case, what yesterday was a reprehensible evil will become today a tolerable foible, and tomorrow the privilege of every taxpayer. Where there is no fear of God, goodness may be present, but it is unreliable and no one ought to risk his life on it. And of course, Rabbi Norman Lamb, he hasn't been around for a few years, but he already saw in his day what has become much more out of control nowadays, which is the issue of moral relativity. The idea that if there is no omniscient, omnipotent, all-wise and knowing and limitless divine being who knows what is best for everyone to dictate morality, morality becomes the preference of an individual or a society. What was moral back then becomes immoral today, and what was immoral back then becomes moral and maybe even praiseworthy nowadays. I'm not going to give any particular examples, but we're all thoughtful people. I'll give one example. You think about, take something which I would hope we could all say is bad. Take something like adultery. So back in the times of the Bible, that was a capital crime. Nowadays, I think in American law, it's not even criminal, if I'm not mistaken. I don't think there's any, lawyers, you can correct me, I don't think there's anything you can really charge someone against. And so we see, and you can think of other examples easily, how morality easily shifts for the convenience of one society to the next. And so without God telling us what is right and what's wrong, what it becomes convenient becomes moral the next day. So that's what Rabbi Lamb is warning us about. And that's ultimately what distinguishes us who are people of faith from living a life without faith. And certainly Pesach night is a night to instill that faith, not just in our family, our friends, but to renew it within ourselves so it carries us through the entire year. With that, we are about to reach the hour point. So we will conclude here. There is much material I didn't cover that's in this Haggadah, so I welcome you to print out if you want to read more. And thank you so much. It was a pleasure learning together. And I'm sure, God willing, I'll see you before then. But wishing you all a Chag Kasher V'Sameach. We shall have a happy Pesach. And apparently, I learned in Stanford, people say not just Chag Kasher V'Sameach, they say Zisim Pesach as well. So you should all have that. Okay. Take care, everyone.
Thank you.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.